All right, well, so Luis and I were talking, and I've mentioned this result to a number of this program to learn, to my horror, that few people knew about it. So I want to bring you up to date on what's going on measuring neutron star redshifts. I think it's something you want to be aware of, especially because I think it's only just beginning. So what I'm going to do is provide a little bit of an overview of possible mechanisms by which you can measure a redshift of a neutron star. And I'm going to focus here on accreting neutron stars. You could give a completely separate discussion of radio pulsars. The problem, I'll tell you, with radio pulsars is they're mostly highly magnetic, and the atomic physics is uncertain. And of course, the name of the game is taking a line you know and love, seeing that it's not at the energy you expect, and blaming that on redshift. I mean, if you have high magnetic fields, that makes that problem much more complicated. So I'm going to overview some of the mechanisms, explain why it's a difficult task. I'll then summarize really the first announced measurement, pretty much, of a spectral line from a neutron star that's been evidenced for gravitational redshift. It was in Nature in the fall. And the researchers who did that were Gene Cottam from Goddard, Fritz Perls from Columbia University, and Mariano Mendez from ESRON in Utrecht. That was a paper in Nature, and I've actually got a few copies here for those of you who want to see it. So I'll go through that measurement, show you why it's worthy of publication, even in a magazine like Nature. It's actually pretty good. It's actually a great result. And then I'll try to explain some of the work that we've been doing here, work that I've done with Phil Chang, who's a graduate student here, who's not in the audience. He knows the work. And also, we collaborated with Fritz Perls on aspects of the radiative transport, which I'm not going to discuss today. And our paper is just coming out in APJ Letters in the July 1 issue. And it really is a paper trying to understand, trying to make initial stab at understanding these observations.
Excuse me.
Yes?
What is spallation?
I'll get to that. Great. This is what I want. I absolutely want you to interrupt. So spallation is breaking nuclei apart by bombardment, and it's something I'll definitely talk about. And please interrupt, okay? This talk was prepared between 8:30 and 10:30 this morning, okay? Though, as you'll see, it was thesis work I did 15 years ago. Shocking. It's archival research for me, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So what's the challenge? The challenge is to produce either an atomic or a nuclear spectral line of a known wavelength. Right, you need a line where you know the wavelength. And of course, that then allows you to identify the redshift by the fact that it's redshifted, an obvious point to this crowd. Now, the place we want this line to be produced also needs to be coming from a radially thin region. We don't want a spectral line that's being produced over 5 kilometers above the neutron star, because the redshift will be varying. So you need to have a place in the star or on the star which is radially very thin extent, and that's where you want the line produced, okay? So all the focus of what I'm going to talk about today are two different mechanisms that have been in the literature for a number of years for producing lines, either atomic or nuclear, from accreting neutron stars from a radially thin region. And it all has to do with what's going on at the location where the infalling material strikes the surface of the neutron star. And so the original work was done by Schwarzman in 1972 on nuclear lines, and I'll talk a little bit about this. This hasn't yet yielded any observations, but it's something that might well happen with integral. And I'll describe this first. And what there are two mechanisms. In any accreting neutron star, let me take one step back. What we typically have is a normal main sequence star, something like the Sun, orbiting a neutron star, orbital period of 5 hours, 8 hours. It's Roche lobe filling, materials leaving the companion star, going into an accretion disk, and eventually arriving at the neutron star surface. And so, of course, the composition of the surface is completely determined by the composition of the infalling material. Okay? So your normal donor star is something like the Sun. So you expect to see helium at 25% by mass, hydrogen at 75% by mass, and then a sprinkling of other elements, carbon, oxygen, iron, etc. Okay, that's what you expect to see. There are some binaries where you have helium, pure helium star donors, or pure carbon-oxygen donors, I'm not going to talk about, those actually might be quite intriguing as nuclear line sources. But the typical system that we see in the sky, out of the 100 low-mass X-ray binaries in our galaxy, have donors which are hydrogen-rich, in which case you have small smatterings of nuclei in that beam. And incoming in that beam, you have carbon, of course, oxygen. Or, as I'll show you in a moment, you can also break up nuclei. So what I didn't say is that the gamma ray line emission mechanism in this case would be going to an excited state of one of these nuclei in a decay, and we know the excited state structure of these nuclei. Another mechanism, and one I'll discuss, is the fact that as the material comes in, it gets broken up or spalled, creating free neutrons. Those free neutrons eventually recombine to form deuterium, giving you a line at the deuterium recombination of 2.2 MeV. Now, just so you know, much of this physics is actually identical to what happens in solar flares. In solar flares, you have accelerated particles that hit the surface of the sun. You see gamma ray lines from these carbon and oxygen. You see a 2.2 MeV line from the sun as well. And I'll discuss this in more detail. So that's one way. Take a line you know and love, a nuclear line. That's a gamma ray astronomy problem. The other game is to take a line from atomic physics. And the first thing that you have to keep in mind is that the temperatures we're talking about at most neutron star surfaces are 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 Kelvin. 10 to the 7 Kelvin is a KT of 1 kilovolt. And so the immediate problem is that hydrogen and helium and carbon and oxygen, those things should be completely ionized. The only real hope is some heavy element. And just to remind you, the binding energy of a hydrogenic iron, which is what will be the focus of the paper that I've talked about, is is 9.2 kilovolts. So that looks hopeful.
What's hydrogenic iron?
That's iron with one electron. Okay. Whispering in the back of the room. Okay, so wake up back there. I'm going to tell you something. So let me describe this particular scenario, which is what we think is happening at the surface of the neutron star. And this is the following. You have your beam coming in at something of order of the free fall. Okay? The density in that beam, the accreting column, is about a million times less dense than the atmosphere. The atmospheric density of the neutron star is actually about that of water. The beam coming in is about a million times less dense. So this incident beam comes in, and the particles are nominally all coming at the same speed, free fall, and they stop at different locations. And this is actually a very important point. They stop, I put the relevant equation on the bottom. I'll put the figure back up. The way in which particles most likely stop is by Coulomb drag on the electrons in the atmosphere. Namely, if you have a proton coming into the atmosphere, it's suddenly in a very dense medium, and that proton is scattering electrons, and that's the viscous drag, if you will, on that proton, fast proton coming in. It's very superthermal. The depth to which it penetrates, which is what we call the stopping depth, scale, this is the Thomson cross-section. This is, of course, the proton to electron mass. This is the initial velocity. This is just the Coulomb logarithm. The main point that's of critical interest here is that for particles all coming in at the same velocity, they actually stop at different depths. They penetrate to different depths in the atmosphere depending on their mass, A, okay, and their charge. And you can understand why they penetrate deeper for the higher mass. That's, of course, just the inertial term, the fact that a proton is, if you will, lighter than a helium nucleus. Okay, but the Coulomb scattering knows about the charge on the nucleus. And so for that reason, the depth of penetration goes like A over Z squared. Okay. So for hydrogen, A over Z squared is 1. Wake up, Joe. For helium, it's 1. Okay. So what's interesting is for protons and helium, they stop at the same location, but everybody else stops sooner. Okay. So here's a schematic of the atmosphere. And actually, this is to scale in the neutron star. This is this radially thin region I'm talking about. Actually, the scale height is about 10 centimeters. This is a little bit blown up. Okay. So the beam comes in, the electrons stop extremely high altitude. Okay, the protons and helium particles stop here, but let's say carbon would stop about here. And what happens to that carbon nucleus then is that it's sitting in a predominantly hydrogen atmosphere, and so it starts to sink, and that's just sort of schematically drawn here. But it's in a place where there's still a very fast proton beam. And so, as I'll show you later, I'll show you some of the understanding of this in terms of more details. This is just a schematic. What happens to this carbon nucleus as it sinks is it actually gets destroyed by this proton beam. Yeah? So this could either be, say, at a polar cap of an X-ray pulsar or in the equatorial belt. So I'm not going to really talk about the area, the extent of the area, but typically for an accretion disk system, we only expect it to be an equatorial plane. So you should think of this as the radial structure. This is all going down, the radial structure, in, for example, the equatorial plane.
Okay. And then how do you get that?
It's to scale.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it's a little bit big. Okay, so it's really 10 centimeters. This whole distance is about 10 centimeters. So I've got it blown up here by a factor of 10. Okay? Yeah,
I guess
great.
It's a stationary solution to the problem, right? What is the typical time scale to reach the solution?
Okay, so I'll talk about that later. The typical time scale to sink through here is 1 second, the gravitational sedimentation time. The destruction time of this particle is actually even shorter for iron, which is the case I'll really discuss in detail for iron because it's more relevant now. Okay?
So for the everything else besides protons and helium, can I approximate n over z squared as 2 over z?
So a goes like, so for carbon oxygen, a would just be 2z, okay? So this would, so these would, as the z goes up, they stop at higher and higher altitude. I don't know if that answers your question. Everybody's fully ionized, I'll tell you. When they come in, the beam is fully ionized.
Yeah. Well,
they're bare nuclei.
I just want to know whether you know, a equals 2z is a pretty good approximation for everything else.
Well, not for iron, it's not, yeah. It's good for the light elements, they're near that, but for very heavy elements, they're very neutron rich, so it's not a good approximation. Iron's a of 56 and z is 26, so that's not bad. Okay, so what I wanted to show about this plot was that this is a way to create a gamma ray line of 4.438 MeV, because not only would you necessarily spall the nucleus, but this proton collision could also just put the nucleus into an excited state, which would then decay, giving you a line, a gamma ray line, that would escape the atmosphere of that energy. Okay, so that's one mechanism to generate gamma ray lines from a radially thin region. Okay. The other mechanism, I didn't have as sexy of a plot for that, is sort of shown here. And this is actually the line that's much better. Have the incident alpha particle as it's coming in. It has to traverse so many protons that actually it has about a 30% chance that it'll get broken up before it even Coulomb stops. So just the beam gets broken apart. So imagine it hits a proton that's just sitting here at rest, chipping out a neutron. So here's the reaction. So you just take the helium-4 and chip out a neutron. That neutron, of course, is a fast neutron moving down. By neutron-proton scattering, it thermalizes. It then, if you put a neutron in an atmosphere like this, it actually sinks in a hydrogen atmosphere. It's because, it's not because it's heavier, it's because it doesn't see the electric field. There's always a hydrostatic electric field in an atmosphere. So it'll sink and drift, and eventually what happens is, on a time scale much shorter than its half-life, okay, because the density here is that of water, it'll capture a proton, form deuterium, and emit a 2.2 MeV gamma ray. So what'll happen from incident helium coming in is you'll make 2.2 MeV gamma rays. Our helium has no bound excited state, so there's no nuclear line from helium. All right, so this is actually the other promising gamma ray line. It's actually the only one that's promising for gamma rays. So what are the punchlines for gamma rays? I'm going to then move on. So for accreting neutron stars with cosmic abundance, sort of solar abundances, the emission from carbon and oxygen is actually quite faint. Our calculations that we did years ago, this is work I did with Ed Salpeter and Ira Wasserman, were so depressing the observers didn't even look. 10 to 100 times too faint for integral. However, this spalled helium liberating neutrons giving you a 2.2 MeV line is actually right at the level that can be looked at from integral and is actually being looked for right now. And of course, it would be a line at 1.8 MeV or 1.7. The advantage to the redshift, I'll just tell you, there's an interesting instrumental aspect. Any gamma ray instrument has usually something in it that's making neutrons. There's always a very big background line at 2.2 MeV in the instrument. So redshift is quite nice. okay, because it takes it out of your instrumental noise. So that's being looked for. There's been no detection. I'm sure you'll hear about that one when it happens. So that's the nuclear situation. It's what there's actually been most of the work done on, and there's no measurements to date. So now let me get to where things are starting to really open up, which are the atomic lines. So the challenge is sort of well described, and actually I used to give this as a homework problem for students to say, why hasn't it happened yet? It wouldn't work that way. Now I have to say why it has happened. But the challenge is the following. If you want to get an atomic feature from a neutron star, you want it to be hot. The reason you want it to be hot is because you get some count rates. You get some, you know, the radius is fixed, you get some counts. The problem if it's hot is all the elements are ionized. Okay? So that's the problem. So let me just walk you through this briefly so you have some sense of why it's a problem. So imagine the brightest I can make a neutron star in terms of its surface temperature is about 2 by 10 to the 7 Kelvin. If it's brighter than that, the luminosity leaving exceeds the Eddington limit. Okay? So 10 to the 7 Kelvin is a rough ballpark maximum temperature. So that's a kilovolt. Okay? KT is a kilovolt. Well, so you can then say, well, imagine we're at of order that temperature. Let's just now look at ionization balance for some hydrogenic species. So take any element you want, carbon, oxygen, iron, and just ask, what's the temperature at which half of those species are completely ionized and half have one bound electron? Okay? So you just write down the chemical potentials for those two species, and you can calculate from that roughly what's the temperature of this, what we call half ionization. And from chemical balance, basically, what you find is that that's, you know, naively you'd say, oh, it's the binding energy. Okay, that's the naive guess. That's wrong. What really matters is the binding energy, but also there's a very large correction to that, which is about a factor of 7, which depends on the states available to the electron in the plasma, what we call the quantum density, versus what the actual electron density is in the gas. So this is really a Saha equation for some of you who've done this, or it's really just writing down the chemical potentials. And this factor is about a factor of 7, and it says that the half ionization for iron is at a temperature of about 1.3 kilovolts for hydrogenic iron. Okay, so if you're hotter than 1.3 kilovolts, the iron should be completely ionized. Okay, that's the problem. And of course, it's even worse for carbon and oxygen. So this is the limit this observation's in, which is why I'll show you, this is basically the regime that this observation is working in, where they're right around this temperature and they see evidence for iron. Well, you could say, okay, well, that's kind of hard, and the only hope is iron. There's no other heavier dominant element. Why am I talking about iron? It's the most abundant heavy element. That's why I mentioned iron. Well, you say, okay, we'll draw the temperature down. Well, of course, then you've got a low count rate in terms of seeing something with an X-ray telescope. Of course, you have lots of atomic physics. For example, if you do the same calculation for oxygen at a lower temperature, you get at the half ionization is around 1 million Kelvin. Of course, 1 million Kelvin is 10 to the 4 times smaller count rate than 10 to the 7 Kelvin. And this is something we've been working on, not haven't had any success yet, but with Chandra, where you can do faint spectroscopy. But the count rates are just a challenge. So this is the best hope. Let me just show you what neutron star atmospheres look like. So these are not exactly what I wanted to really show you, but it gives you an example of the prevalence of atomic physics. Just look at this left plot. So this is from Slava Zavalin and George Pavlov. These are showing hydrogen, helium, and actually pure iron atmospheres. These are very extreme. And so you can see here, this is at 10 to the 6.5. So that's 3 by 10 to the 6 Kelvin. This is the iron atmosphere. Of course, you can see that it's extremely rich in atomic physics. No surprise. All right, so let me get to the observation. So the name of the neutron star is there. For those of you who don't know how to translate these, this means it was found by EXOSAT, which was a European satellite in the mid-80s. This is the right ascension, 7 hours, 48 minutes. This is the declination, minus 667. Okay, so those are those call numbers. It's a low-mass X-ray binary, meaning it has a donor which is predominantly hydrogen-rich. The orbital period is about 3.8 hours. The distance to the binary is given there. It's roughly distance to the galactic center, though it's not at the galactic center. galactic center is at 17 hours minus 30, okay, so it's not the galactic center. That's the X-ray luminosity, around 10 to the 36 ergs per second, about a hundredth of the Eddington ring. Okay. This system, at this accretion rate, undergoes what are called type 1 X-ray bursts, and this is the key to this result. If you're adding hydrogen and helium onto a neutron star at this rate, roughly speaking, once every 10 hours or so, that hydrogen and helium that accumulates undergoes a thermonuclear ignition and explodes, in which case you suddenly get a very bright flux coming from the neutron star. Okay? This X-ray luminosity is the accretion luminosity. The accretion luminosity coming in, which is the 100 to 200 MeV per nucleon, but that's in the disk. And that's some god-awful mess when it hits the surface. That's sort of not what you want. What you want is emission coming from the star. So what they did was the following. You want to look during these bursts. That's what you want to do because it's a really bright source. Temperature is 10 to the 7 Kelvin. Okay? It's coming from the neutron star. The problem is that the duty cycle of these is roughly 100 seconds every 5 hours. Okay? So how do you get enough data? Well, the way you get enough data is to have it be a calibration source. Okay? So this source was looked at by XMM Newton as a calibration commissioning source. They looked at it for 6 days straight. Okay? So this is a lot of observation. They saw 28 of these bursts, which gave them a total amount of 3,000 seconds of data to use. Okay? So out of 6 days of observation, the amount of data usable for this investigation is 3,000 seconds. Because it's probably not something that would have succeeded at a peer review, because it's risky. Okay? So it was done with data that had been obtained in a different way, and as you can imagine now, a lot of people are proposing to get data for this purpose, and will probably succeed. So, as I said, the investigators are Gene Cottam at Goddard, Fritz Perls at Columbia, and Mariano Mendez at Utrecht. And it was done with the RGS, which is a grating spectrometer on XMM Newton. I don't know the story of why the source was chosen as a calibration source, and we'll probably never know. Let me just show you what these bursts look like. These are not the bursts. This is the sort of discovery. This is our exosat data, of just to give you a sense of what these bursts look like. So marching along, if you just stare at the object, you see luminosity coming from the accretion. This is the light coming from accretion of material onto there, so it's liberating the gravitational binding energy. That's marching along. Then you suddenly see this bright flash. This is the X-ray burst. As you can see, the duration on this is, I'm showing you, about a minute. So these things last 20 to 150 seconds. And so this is the data they'd use. So as I'll show you in a minute, they do this. The first thing to say is, you might say, well, nuclear energy is only 5 MeV per nucleon. Accretion energy is a few hundred MeV per nucleon. How does a nuclear burning ever become visible? Well, it becomes visible because you store up the energy for 5 hours and burn it in 10 seconds. Okay, so that's why you can see that thermonuclear energy. Okay, so let me give you some numbers. So those were old data. They don't actually show these plots. This is a Nature paper, so there's not much detail. But for what they found, they had peak luminosities that were 15 times the accretion. Namely, contrast at the bright end was up 15 times from this. Their peak count rate was about 9 counts per second. Okay, it's a grating spectrometer, so there's a lot of loss in throughput. And the burst they saw lasted from 50 to 130 seconds. Okay, so you can tell from this that they don't have a lot of photons. And so what they did was all they could do, which is they took all the bursts they had, all 28 or 30. They had spectra for all those bursts. And they added them up into two bins. Okay? So they took, let me just use this as an example, they took all of the bursts and they then chopped them roughly in two to a bright phase and so-called dim phase. And the reason to do that is in some sense, you know that the surface temperature is changing through here, and you know that the ionization balance could well be changing. Okay? So they basically took all the bursts, added them all up. They've got roughly 10 to the 4 photons, split them in two, so they have a bright phase and a dim phase spectrum. And what I'm going to show you is the result. Okay, so is that clear?
Is it obvious that the spectrum changes between the two phases?
Yes. So these are the data. Okay. So the top is the bright phase, and the bottom is the dim phase. Now you might say, wow, there's a lot of lines there, and that's true. There are a lot of lines there. This system, like all neutron stars, has a tremendous amount of what you call circumstellar material, material that's surrounding, that's in the binary, that's not down near the surface of the neutron star, that's out at the orbital separation, that's being fluoresced by the X-rays. That they have to model and then fit, and that's this blue line. Okay? So the blue line is showing basically what we call the circumstellar material. The line they called attention to is this one, which, because I've muddied it up, it looks a little bit worse than it is, I think, because of the way I've filled it in. This line, which actually has 1, 2, 3, about 6 independent bins. This is extremely high energy resolution data. This is wavelengths and angstroms. And the bin size, I don't know if it's here. These bins are independent. These are not correlated bins. It's a grating spectrometer, so you just spread the spectrum out. So they have, in this spectrum, roughly 6 low bins. So this is the line that they call attention to, which they identify. So they have one line in the bright phase spectrum that's unexplained. They identify it. They say, well, OK, that is the Balmer 2-3 transition of hydrogenic iron. Okay, so the n equals 2 to n equals 3 of hydrogenic iron. That's what that line is. And the redshift, and of course, it's not where it should be. And that's the redshift. Okay. Now, if they just had that, actually, I don't think anybody would feel comfortable with the result. Okay. I think the reason to ponder the result and take it seriously is the dim phase spectrum. The temperature's colder. Okay. And when the temperature's colder, you would expect, and you can calculate, that the ionization state should change from hydrogen-like to helium-like. The line they see here has disappeared, but they see a different line, which, given the fact that they've already measured the redshift, matches helium-like Balmer 2-3. Okay, that's the reason. So they have two spectral lines, right? But you see the difficulty with the game. I mean, that's why I want to walk through it.
Why that particular transition as opposed to any other?
Okay. Yeah, that I'll get into that a little bit. Okay. Well, let me get into it right now. Lyman alpha is out of their band. They can't see it. So the 1 to 2, they can't see. Same goes for the 3 to 4, the Patchen series. So for what they can see with their spectral band, this is it for iron. Okay. There's other data by other instruments, and you might get worried about whether someone should have seen Lyman alpha. If this line is this strong, what does it imply the strength is at Lyman alpha? Okay. That's something that I think nobody yet has figured out how to calculate. There, it ends up, when you start looking at the radiative transfer problem, it's not simple. It's a nice way to say it. So we can't say to date whether, for example, what we can't say is if this is true, how much iron does it imply? We thought we could, but we've decided we can't, that we don't yet understand how to do the radiative transport for this line. And the main reason is that this is a very strong radiative environment, that you're in an extremely high flux environment, and actually the ionization balance in the radiative transport is being driven by the radiation field. It's more like the interstellar medium than it is a star. Okay. But so for iron, they're okay in the sense there's not something they would have expected in their band that they don't see. Okay. Okay. So that's the data. That's it.
Do they know anything? There appear to be some extra lines.
Yeah. So there's debate. They claimed these were oxygen, which was crazy, and they kind of said they were crazy too. So these are unexplained still.
And in the upper plot,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's cause for concern. You start to get worried if you see, 15 low bins, and one is where this is the statistics game that you don't really want to get into, or more importantly, you don't want them to start splitting up their data anymore. So people have asked them, well, what if you take, is this just from one burst? It was really strong, and the other 25 bursts were really weak. Well, they can't answer that, right? And the last thing you want them doing is going out and doing, 1,000 more trials.
So you said that this is all complicated by strong magnetic fields.
No, sorry. So and radio pulsars, it's complicated by strong magnetic fields. I didn't say about these systems. The magnetic field strength in these systems is unknown. We think it's weaker than 10 to the 8 Gauss. At 10 to the 8 Gauss, the electron, cyclotron energy is much, much less than any of these energy scales. Okay, so we don't think there's a strong shift of the line or modification of the line center due to a magnetic field in this system. If you start asking about line shapes and is there a Zeeman effect, it's a different question, and that gets complicated too. But we think the lines are not subject to magnetic field shifts, large shifts.
Is this the redshift you would expect from your favorite neutron star?
Okay, so
you have the equations of state with it.
Very good. Okay, so what does it mean? So that's the number. So in your units, it's 4.4. Okay, it's less than 6m. That's interesting for modeling the system. It's less than the last stable orbit. So here's your messy accretion disk. Here's 6m. The neutron star is inside 6m. So there should be a region where the material plunges in. The disk does not probably run into the star. There's probably a region where the material plunges in. So for those of us who like things like meters, there it is. It's 9.2 kilometers for a mass of 1.4. The mass of the neutron star in this case is not known. We don't know the mass. So let me show you the next plot, which is the one you're asking about. Here it is. So these are, as you've all seen these, this plot is from Latimer and Prakash. So I've drawn on here the radius mass relation from that redshift measurement. That's the blue line. Okay, so that's the 4.4m. On top of here are multitudes of different equations of state, and as you can see, it doesn't rule out really anything. And the R infinity measurements, this is the radiation radius that you can get from spectroscopy that have been done with Chandra for 1.4 solar mass neutron stars. R infinity of 12 is what we've been getting. It's actually about right in here. So that actually is holding up as well. Here's strange stars as well, if you like those. So it doesn't cause any trouble. A little alarmingly close to what we expected. Okay, so for those of you doing coalescing neutron stars, I don't know if that's going to matter to you that much. I mean, it says the breakup, the final frequency is higher than you might have guessed, is the only real difference, right? For the coalescence problem. Okay.
That might be a good thing.
It might be good.
Lie open to the way we just positron
interpret. I'd never say that, especially while on tape. Okay, so in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I want to talk about sort of the initial theoretical work we've been doing. This is with Phil Chang and Fritz Perls about where's this iron from? Let's take it as a given that the iron's there. And let's now try to understand, should there be iron? How do we understand it? How does iron get there? The immediate thing that comes to mind is you say, well, you've got this dramatic type 1 burst going on that's definitely making iron. Maybe it's just iron that's been, you're burning, you're making iron. Maybe it's just that iron. We think that's quite unlikely. The reason is very simple, is that even when you're burning that material down at depth, it's actually quite deep in the star, and the entropy there is actually lower than the entropy at the photosphere. So there is a convective zone, but it doesn't even get close to the photosphere. Okay, and I'm just sort of giving you numbers here. And this was first pointed out by Paul Joss. So if you just ask what's the entropy, it's roughly, especially during the flash, roughly given by just ideal gas. There it is. I mean, you can just compare this thing in the log at the photosphere versus at the burning layer, and you can see there's about a factor of 1,000 in the log. In this. So the entropy in the photosphere is actually quite high. Okay, so we don't think iron that's at the burning layer can actually get up. Well, what if during the burst the accretion shuts off? You could imagine there could be iron there while you're accreting, but if during the type 1 burst the accretion were to shut off, what would happen? Well, the iron, being heavier than the predominant species, hydrogen, would fall. And the drift speed is about a centimeter per second, which means that it would only take about a second to fall beneath the photosphere. So there's a place where the radiation is coming from. That's what we mean by the photosphere. If you put iron above there and just let go, in about a second it'll fall through. And the burst lasts 10 to 100 seconds. Okay? So what that means is that, given these two points, it probably tells us that the only way you can understand the iron being up there is that the accretion is still going on during the flash, during the type 1 burst. Okay? So, I didn't bring all the data, but there's a fair amount of phenomenology that actually shows reasonably well that you do see not just photospheric emission from the neutron star during a type 1 burst, but the disk is still present in other systems. In this system, we don't know. But it is true that the type 1 burst doesn't exceed the Eddington limit for this neutron star. You could imagine if it gets very bright, you could see the Eddington limit, you could start to hold back accretion flow. In this system, these bursts aren't that bright. So we're going to, what I'm going to talk about today, we're going to presume the same rate that it had before the burst, which is this number, 2 by 10 to the minus 10 solar masses per year. As I said, there's a last stable orbit. If you just do the integration, actually Tony Pyro did this first, of just asking if it leaves the last stable orbit, what's it hit at? It'll hit at a grazing incidence of sine theta of about 1, and energy per nucleon of 200 to 300 MeV. Okay. So the question is, if you have iron coming in at an incident abundance of iron to protons of solar, which is 3 by 10 to the minus 5, so if you go in the sun and you count the iron nuclei and divide it by the number of protons, that's the number, what's the fate of that iron? Well, this is the average. I don't actually know where. Yeah. So. Where?
You're digging down into the donor star, I guess.
Oh yeah. So we don't know actually for this donor star what the iron abundance is. We don't know. Okay. So we're just going to say it's solar. Unfortunately, you're right. We don't know it. Okay. So what happens to that iron? Well, here's now a blow up of that plot I showed earlier. So again, the iron coming in, of course, if you're coming in a grazing incidence, all you do is just change the scales by sine theta, so it doesn't really change this plot, it just squishes it down. So it's coming in this way, I've just ignored that for now. So the iron stops at a high altitude, that's good, the photosphere is here. Here's where the radiation comes from. You want iron above there to put on the absorption line, so that's good news. The iron stops above where you want, where you need it. Starts to sink, and as I said earlier for the carbon story, what actually happens is the incident protons break that nucleus apart. Because there's a proton current in the beam, a fast proton current coming in at 100 to 200 MeV per nucleon, so a third the speed of light, at a number per square centimeter per second given by this, where m dot's the global rate, and I'm just presuming for now spherical accretion, so that's the rate per unit area, divided by just the baryon mass, the proton mass. So this is the number of protons per square centimeter per second. That's that proton current. And this nuclear, the iron, actually gets broken apart by the protons. And it ends up that for iron, life is very simple. So while sinking, you can just ask, well, what's the destruction timescale? So that iron gets put in. I told you it takes a second to sink beneath the photosphere. But if you ask, what's the timescale for it to get broken up by the protons, that's given by the destruction cross-section, the nuclear spallation cross-section, roughly the size of the nucleus, the pi r squared, and the proton current. And if you're accreting, this is now just the local rate. This is at the rate we implied before. It's about 3 milliseconds. So the lifetime of the iron is not set by sinking through. It's set by being broken up. The iron only lives for a few milliseconds in the atmosphere, as long as the accretion rate is still going on. Okay, so the iron residence time is completely set by nuclear physics rather than sedimentation. That's the key. And as I'll show you, then of course you have a nuclear cascade. I make manganese, and the manganese starts to sink, but then it gets broken up. It's chromium, vanadium, titanium, scandium. So you get a plethora of elements, which I'll show you in a minute. Well, the advantage of this is we get this following very simple punchline. Which is, as long as the accretion rate during the burst is at least more than 1% of what it was before, that's just as long as the nuclear physics is setting the residence time. Okay, so we had 3 milliseconds versus a second. So as long as you're safely in that regime, then there's a very simple calculation for the total column of iron in the atmosphere. So this is the amount of iron per square centimeter is NFE. That's the number per square centimeter, okay? So I can just write down a rate equation. This is the, I change the amount of iron in the atmosphere by depositing it from accretion. So this is the proton beam. This is the incident abundance. So this is the deposition rate of iron in the atmosphere. This is the destruction rate of iron given by the proton current, the current amount of iron, and the destruction cross-section. And if I'm in steady state, which I think I should be, then of course these two equal, and you're done. You get a total column of iron expected of 4 by 10 to the 19 per square centimeter for solar abundances. And the beauty of that is it's independent of the accretion rate. So the point is, if the accretion, this is this question of steady state. The steady state is being set on this very short time scale of 10 milliseconds. If the accretion rate fluctuates up and down, it doesn't matter. If you put a little bit more in, it gets destroyed that much faster. And if you put a bit less in, it gets destroyed that much slower. And so the column of iron is basically this pure number. Okay? And what we don't know yet, and we'd like to really answer, is this amount of iron capable of producing the observed line? We don't. I can't answer that right now. Don't know the answer. Well, you can then just carry this forward. You can say, well, let's write down all the rate equations for everything. We don't expect there to be any manganese in the beam. That's for sure. There's no manganese or chromium in a star compared to iron. But you're going to be making it. So I can write down a rate equation for, let's say, chromium. And there would be production of spalling all the elements that are heavier and destruction by the proton beam beating that thing up. And then you can just calculate for all of these nuclear cross-sections, which was a joy to gather, what's the spallation? What's the cascade? What's the abundance of all these nuclei? And you get a very interesting answer. So this is from the paper we've just published. So here shows, so let me just walk through briefly. So here's iron. Let's just set that to 1. This is the total column would be, you know, it was 1. We're showing here the ionization edge and the redshifted value. So this is the photoionization edge for hydrogenic iron. That's the binding energy, if you will, of hydrogenic iron. Over here is this KT 1/2, this number I sort of schematically told you was about 1.3 kilovolts. When you do it a little bit better, you get 1.12. That's a half ionization state. Okay, so you break that up, you make a lot of elements, let's say manganese, it'll have a column density that's only 40% smaller than the iron. Okay, chromium, vanadium, titanium, you can keep going, and none of these elements are in the beam. Okay, you don't expect these elements in the beam. And their advantage is that as the atmosphere cools, the KT, of course, these have lower KT halves, and you might well catch one of these elements, either as a photoionization edge, or as we've shown here, the Balmer alpha line. Okay. So rather than just have one Heise element, for this sort of scenario where the beam really stops in the atmosphere, you expect a large number of Heise elements. And the total integral of all these is, of course, much more than the iron, right? And that's just because it still has to sink, okay? It's still sinking. So the residence time of those nuclei, even though they're getting chipped apart, is still quite long. So you can get an integrated abundance is actually quite large, okay? And this might have some spectral impact that's not yet been worked out. I mean, these elements do provide a little bit of opacity. Okay, so what's the future? Well, I think, I mean, it's hard to know. The Chandra review is coming up. XMM, I don't know, when's the next XMM review? This month. So, as you can imagine, many people have put in requests which will look like an observation that's happened. This is the normal trend. And I think something will be approved. I'm not on the review panel, but these are big observations. These are not gimmies to get that much time. We're hoping that the observers will actually search for these previously unexpected lines from funny elements you wouldn't expect to be there. And that just, as I said, sort of gives us much richer possibilities for atomic features than just being stuck with iron. And Integral is actually searching for these gamma ray lines right now. So hopefully the main message I wanted to get across is that this field of neutron star spectroscopy is actually just now starting. There's been a lot of results on radio pulsars, which I'm not talking about, as well, of seeing spectral lines, mostly, though, having to do with magnetic fields. So this field's opening up, and it's really just the beginning, and XMM and Fermi-Chandra are doing quite well. Astro-E2, which is a spectrometer, not a grating spectrometer, but one based on superconducting, basically calorimeters. It's being launched, David, do you know the year? 2005. And that actually, you know, we'll be able to do some of the science as well. So I think the days are still early, but it should be getting just that much more exciting. Thanks.
Are these questions? First recurrent times stable enough that you could get your data efficiency up from 1%
okay.
to 10 or 20?
There is one burster for which the answer is yes. Most of them are not that stable. There's one burster where it's regular as a clock. The problem is, until you've looked at it, you don't know what the period's going to be. So you'd have to do a coordinated observation with a cheaper instrument to find the recurrence time and then tell. Now, the recurrence times are typically 4 hours. And if Chandra or XMM isn't going to be happy pointing, you know, staring for 10 minutes and then changing targets to come back, I can't imagine that. It's sort of a scheduling nightmare, but that would be a great way to do it. But I think the overhead would probably, I don't know. I mean, if anyone's even proposing that. But there is one system where it's quite periodic. Yeah.
This is probably a stupid question, but you said at the beginning it's very important to have the emission coming from a shell because that gives you your R.
Right.
In your acid.
Right.
Now, if you're doing this during a burst, mm-hmm. I expect that the photosphere will not be right on top of the surface, will be up higher.
Okay.
And so the R you estimate mm-hmm. is really the R of the photosphere.
Correct.
How big is the difference, and
okay.
don't worry about it.
So if you don't exceed the Eddington limit, then the radius of the photosphere is basically at the surface of the star. You know, what you're asking, so if you get the Eddington limit, then the photosphere can go out to 20 kilometers. Then you're in trouble, obviously. Okay. So the if you just ask how much is the atmosphere lifted up during the flash, that's about 10 meters. So there is a 10-meter shift mm-hmm. during the burst, okay? But that's 10 meters out of 10 kilometers.
It's the spin of this.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I forgot to say. So we don't know the spin for this guy. All of the neutron stars like this, where spins have been measured, are rapidly rotating at 200 to 600 hertz. If you presume that for this neutron star, then probably some of that line width you could see in the data. Maybe you couldn't see it, but some of the line width is probably just rotational broadening.
Okay.
In the sense that, you know, the V over C effects are large, and so the photons on, are getting, well, it's basically just Doppler shift.
This burst is localized around the stars, isn't
it? So we don't know for this system whether or not the burst was localized on a given spot or not for this system. Many bursts appear to be mostly covering the star, but to have on top of that some asymmetry at the level of 5%. So again, you could worry about that shifting things around, but they couldn't answer any of those questions with this data. Yeah. Great. Thanks.